The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is a show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. The podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, we have a great show for you today. We're going to talk about an area we really don't talk much about here, and that is self-storage, which is really a hot asset area right now in real estate. And we've got a guy who is a true expert in this area. His name is Scott Crone, and he's the founder of Coda Management, a company that teams up with investors to purchase undervalued warehouse space and converts the space into climate-controlled self-storage facilities that are managed by a top three operator. With over 47 syndications and 400,000 square feet with 2,750 storage units under management, Scott has over 25 years of development and design building experience. Wow. Well, Scott, welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Thanks for having us. We're really looking forward to this time.
Oh, well, me too. This is a great area, and you've got a great story too. And I just love you just to give a little background on how you got into real estate in general, and specifically the self-storage area. Maybe you can just tell us where you came from and give us some background.
Absolutely. Well, my family had a family business I was going to be fourth generation in the die casting industry. And my father showed up my senior year of college and said, "Hey, what are you planning on doing next year?" And I really thought that I would be going into the family business. And I said, "Well, I figured I'm going to be working for you." And he said, "Well, you're not going to be." And my immediate reaction was like, "Okay, what did I do wrong? am I getting grounded?"
Shocker.
It was a big shocker. I mean, this is something that my great grandfather started, and it was in my mind a very successful company. And not to say that it wasn't, but my father said, "Well, we're selling the business," and it was a real paradigm change for our family, because my whole life that had been part of my grandfather worked there, my uncle worked there, my dad worked there. And so it was everything that we knew from a business perspective was related to the family business. And so, the market was changing, it was going abroad, and they felt it was the time to sell. So, my father said, "Well, you know, you've always had an interest in architecture. Why don't you consider going back into that? And I thought that it was too late, having, you know, gotten an undergraduate degree in history and not in architecture. And that's when I learned that there was master's degrees for people similar to in my situation that didn't have the undergraduate degree. And that's how I got back involved with architecture and real estate.
Interesting. And I mean, that is something a lot of us don't really even grasp, the idea of having a multi-generational business like that in your family. And just kind of moving forward, assuming, well, this is, you know, going to be my baby one day. And wow, that had to be just a real eye opener. Whereabouts are you guys located?
The business was in Chicago, and Chicago. They made parts for, you know, Ludwig drums and Schwinn bicycles and Ford and the military. And so, these weren't small time contracts. They were pretty, and Harley Davidson was another big vendor. And so, they made all the aluminum die castings for those companies.
Man, oh man. But it's interesting. Your dad had sort of the foresight to see, you know, at least at a certain time in history. I know, just a lot of, especially Midwest, businesses and companies just got hit as things started going offshore. And, you know, for him to sort of anticipate that might happen, he didn't want it to hit you when you took over the business. And, that was really a pretty, insightful for him.
It was, I mean, the year prior they were awarded by the U.S. government for Small Business of the Year. So, you know, they got a tour of the White House and the flag that was flown over the White House at the time and all those sorts of things. And it was a real big honor. And they were, you know, a $3 million business in revenue, in sales. And they felt that they just couldn't make a go of it, which was my first real introduction to market timing and understanding the marketplace and looking for those indicators within the marketplace as to knowing when to get in and when to get out.
Well, it looks like, you know, from your story here, that you did have a, you know, pretty good idea. I mean, you went into architecture, but obviously it doesn't seem like that's the primary focus of where you're at right now. How did you sort of make that transition from architecture to the self-storage industry?
So my first year in graduate school, I began to realize that, you know, the architects weren't the ones that made a lot of money. It was the real estate developers. And one of the professors at IIT owned a real estate development company where he controlled the entire process. So it was from the development to the architecture to the contracting. And I became his TA, and I began working for him in his office from 7 in the morning until noon. And then from 1 to 6, I'd go to class. And then from, you know, 7 until midnight, I'd be doing more homework, quote unquote, homework for him, which was more work on his projects. And that's where I really learned the development side of it, and recognizing that there was more opportunity in terms of controlling the process, controlling, you know, the growth and all those sorts of things, as opposed to being dependent upon someone else to give you a job. With a developer, you create the work. And so that was the biggest takeaway and how I got involved in real estate development.
And what kind of projects was that company involved in?
They were top 20 builder within the multifamily arena. So, you know, my master's thesis was a $100 million development with 400 units. And so while I worked for him, I was working on another 40 unit development and a 57 unit development. And then we were also converting apartments to condos.
And a lot of ground up development, or were you mainly, you know, rehabbing? Were you doing everything?
The conversions were existing facilities that they had built and converting them, you know, moving them off of the passive income into, you know, an active sales. But all of the other development was ground up. So, you know, the $100 million one was the old Sara Lee factory. So we took that down and you know, developed it from scratch. It was a 50 acre site.
Wow. That had to be an amazing education, just everything with dealing with, you know, major contractors to the, you know, the architects, as well as I'm sure the sales side of it as well. That's amazing. That's a great background.
It was. And the reason why I was able to take advantage of it so much is I was the only one in the program in his company that didn't come directly from the School of Architecture. I came from an undergraduate degree. So, you know, I was more proficient at reading and writing. So that's why I got, instead of being thrown onto the design boards, I got thrown in terms of working with the CEO and the CFO and working underneath them. So everything from negotiating the land contracts to the condominium decks to the loan docs to working with buyers to bidding things out for the different subcontractors. So I was really involved in all the other areas of the company as opposed in doing the financial performance. So I was heavily involved in terms of that and modeling out the revenue side. And so as opposed to just doing the design work.
Well, it sounds like you had a very promising career path staying on with that company, but it sounds like you kind of, you know, found your own niche here. How did that happen?
I worked there for about 6 years, and I was asked by the CEO to go and work with him starting up a new development company. And so I decided to leave that to go work with him on a more, you know, moving up the ladder in terms of responsibility. And that company had its own challenges. And I was only there for about 6 months when, you know, the analysis that I put together showed that the project that they were working on was not going to be as successful as they had hoped. And so, you know, I proposed to them, like, why don't I work for you part-time while I start my own thing? And then that way you don't have the burden of my salary to pull you down, but I'd still be offering the support that they needed. And so we came to that arrangement, and that's how I started Coda 20 years ago. And we our first, you know, real estate deal was buying a house for $300,000, tearing it down, building a new one, and selling it for over $1 million.
Wow. Wow. And have you been primarily focused in the Midwest area or Chicago area, or did you move into other areas beyond that?
For the first, I will say 18 years, we were focused specifically around the Chicagoland market, doing single family, multifamily, mixed use. We've done four churches. We've helped them out in that process. But within the last few years, we've expanded beyond the Midwest. So now we're in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Ohio.
Wow. So you started off just doing a variety of projects, you know, commercial. It sounded like you started off residential and then started moving into, you know, bigger commercial type projects.
Yeah, we were predominantly in the residential arena, either single family or multifamily, until the big crash. And that's when we had to make the transition outside of just the speculative, you know, residential side, because the banks weren't lending on it. And so that's when we began buying distressed apartments and other distressed commercial properties. And that was my first introduction into the self-storage arena and what are the, you know, the financial milestones or projections or processes that you have to hit in order to make it work. And that's when we took that model and then began expanding it, you know, throughout the Midwest.
Is this around what, the 2008, 2010, 12, around that area?
It was around 2008 and 9 that we began getting more heavily into the commercial. And it was in 13 that we began working on the first self-storage facility.
And you mentioned that the banks were, you know, tight of funds. I mean, everybody was definitely aware of that during that time period. But how did you fund your projects there, you know, taking distressed properties?
Well, keep in mind that, you know, banks were still reeling in terms of, you know, what they would lend, and self-storage, especially on the speculative concept, was still outside their wheelhouse. They weren't as, I mean, they were lending to apartments all day long. And in my mind, you know, a self-storage facility is exactly the same as an apartment building, but you don't have the toilets and the showers. And so it's a much simple, you know, simplistic version of an apartment building at a fraction of the cost basis. So it didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me, but people would say, like, well, how do you know how to build a self-storage facility? I'm like, well, I built $100 million, you know, apartment buildings. I can certainly build, you know, corrugated steel walls with no plumbing and no toilets. You know, it's a lot right. easier to do. So right. we had to go to non-traditional banks in order to get the financing. And then because of the fact that, you know, lenders were still reeling at that time.
Ah, I see. And did you start taking in investors at that point, or was that later on?
Every project that we've done, we've had investors, you know, beginning with the first single family house that we did 20 years ago. Oh. You know, I had three investors there, and it was an eye-opening experience because they were very pleased with the rate of return we gave them. They said, do it again, and then don't tell anybody else. <That's when> I love it. So that was weird. A little bit of a light bulb moment that maybe I was onto something here.
And you decided not to go into like housing developments. I mean, even though it was for your first project, right? Is that mainly because of just the crisis hitting?
No, back then it was more along the lines of, I was 28 years old, you know, so to get people to buy into a 28 year old, to do massive developments was very hard to do. So, you know, I felt that we had to build and grow the company. And, you know, rather than just, you know, trying to do a 50 unit development right off the bat. And so we began working with single family. And then the first multifamily that we did was a 12 unit. And then we did a condo, which was 13 units. And we just began building it that way.
Interesting. You know, one thing that really sparked, you know, you talk about converting warehouse facilities. You know, I think there's a lot of folks that don't recognize necessarily, unless you live in the Midwest and in the Rust Belt specifically, you know, just the number of abandoned businesses and factories there are out there. I mean, I remember, you know, I was looking for apartments in Indianapolis area, and, you know, went outside of Indy and started, you know, checking out these other areas. And I would just see these massive, you know, it looks like, I mean, at one time, a huge manufacturing facility just totally abandoned. And they're, you know, unfortunately, you know, with so much business moving offshore into, you know, Mexico and all these other places, I know that just a number of businesses were just hit severely, you know, a Carrier and some of the other major ones in the Indy area, a lot of automotive related businesses. And it's to hear what you've done, you know, is one of these guys that can grab some of these old warehouses that are out there and then turn it into something where there's a strong demand, especially in today's market. That's pretty smart. I mean, it really looked like you moved into a great niche there.
Well, thank you. It's not just warehouses, though. I mean, we really look at any large commercial space. So we've taken warehouses, we've taken offices, you know, some of them were even storage, but the way in which the storage was utilized back then, I mean, they didn't have the need for individual self-storage because of the fact that, you know, a bank needed to keep its financial records, but it was like boxes and boxes and boxes of paper copies. And so, you know, how the economy has changed and gone digital is, to me, is no different than, you know, when we were tearing down single family homes, people would say, like, well, why are you tearing down that old house? You should be restoring it. And there's a useful lifespan for a building, and there's a useful lifespan for a house. And the way in which we use property changes over time. And so we have to look at how can we maximize the use of that property as we have changed. You know, it's no different than the rest of the society that we've evolved and developed and, you know, making better use of technology. So why would we not expect our real estate also to do that? And that's the biggest thing that we try to do is say, how can we create a better and more effective use for this property by changing the use? And so that's one of the things that we've really taken advantage of.
So you must have a very thorough effort in terms of research in that particular market as to what, you know, what really the needs are for that community and for that that area of the country, I would imagine.
Yeah, we spend a great deal of money on feasibility reports. And so we will not go into a venture or even, you know, a firm contract on a piece of property without that feasibility study and knowing what the results of it are. And that is the key driver for us, because if the feasibility report is negative, then there's no point in us trying to fight upstream. You know, I'd rather go with the flow of the, you know, the river than trying to fight it upstream.
Yeah, looks like, you know, to me, one of the areas that'd be sort of the biggest challenge is, you know, you find this great warehouse, you can get it for a great price, but if there's not the demand in that area for it, that, you know, that would really hurt. How do you assess the demand for self-storage?
The most basic metric is the number of square feet of lockers per capita. And where supply equals demand is around 7 square feet of lockers per capita. And so if we buy well below that metrics, we know that there's going to be a natural buying pattern where we can model it out, and it's very predictable. And once we approach or get above it, then, you know, it's simple economics, supply equals demand. So your lease up time will be longer. You won't get as much revenue because everyone will be fighting for the same dollars. And so that's where we, you know, we were looking at one facility in Arizona, which would have pushed us above 7 square feet. And we decided not to pursue that one because we felt it was just too much risk. So the ones that we have bought have been like between 1.6 square feet per locker per capita to three. And so we're making sure that we're always well below where supply equals demand.
What about your target customer? Don't they have to certain sort of criteria in terms of, you know, what their average salaries are or what their, you know, the home ownership percentages are and things of that nature?
Absolutely. But keep in mind, there are two different clients. You know, businesses also rent from self-storage. They might not need a whole warehouse, but they, you know, they just need a place to store their off-season type stuff or extra inventory or supplies or whatever it may be. But the medium income and the demographics in that sense also dictates the makeup or the configuration of our lockers. So the one says that we have demand. The other one says, what do we fill that demand with? You know, how big, what is the average square foot of the lockers? Like, for instance, in more affluent communities, then we will build bigger lockers because they're willing to pay a higher price per square foot for a larger locker. In less affluent communities, they're willing to pay a higher premium for smaller lockers. And so in less wealthy communities, we will then put, you know, a higher percentage of smaller lockers in it. So our medium will go from 90 square feet down to about 75 square feet per on average for the locker.
Hmm. And what percentage of your self-storage business is sort of industrial versus consumer?
I would still say majority of it is residential, but there, you know, in each community we will have it. So for instance, in our Toledo one, I would expect it to be around 50-50. And you know, in our Chicago or Milwaukee one, I think it's going to be higher because in those communities we have over 500,000 people within 3 miles and over 60% of them are renters. And so we have an incredibly high percentage of renters in those areas.
Got it. Yeah. I would imagine, yeah, rental, just the rental market would be a key factor in estimating, you know, whether or not there's a strong demand, I would think.
That is schools, you know, like universities, that's another big factor. So it's each of those things will play a factor in terms of, you know, how we lay out the building.
And does your company do only self-storage or do you have any other percentage, any other types of development you do?
We have two businesses. One is a design build firm, which we then help out our customers develop properties. So whether that be a single family house or right now we're actually doing a church. So we help the church, you know, find the property, acquire the property, entitle the property, get them the financing. We designed it and then we're building it for them. And then our investment side, we are only doing self-storage at this point in time. We sold off the apartments. We've stopped doing the single family and the multifamily, and our investment side is strictly self-storage.
Got it. Well, with 20 years of experience here, you know, running your own show, I mean, you must have encountered some things that were a little bit more challenging. And one of the questions we ask a lot of our guests is sort of, what would you say sort of your biggest mistake and what did you learn from that mistake?
Well, I think my biggest mistake is I got involved with some people that were not the most beneficial for the company. And, you know, what I took away from that is, you know, I probably learned more in that than my greatest success. You know, the importance of having systems in place in order to monitor performance in terms of making sure that things are being done well and being done appropriately. And then also to make sure that, you know, that you can remove yourself from the business and elevate yourself up in the business so other people can take over those jobs. And so that transformation allowed us to really see the need of how to properly expand the company, because I recognized that I had to invest more of our resources and training so that I could get the right people into the right jobs.
Mm, That's great. Well, you answered my second question then. The biggest success is really setting up those systems, right, that really allowed you that kind of flexibility for growth and as well. So that's great.
I think that's up there, but I think for us, the biggest success was just being able to survive the biggest recession in our history. You know, I mean, that was a major downturn and how we were able to adapt the company to be able to succeed in both a downturn market as well as an upturn market.
Was your company, was it fairly big at that point when the recession hit?
No, because I began seeing the signs that the market was going to be corrected. I mean, when Greenspan was saying how we needed to pop the real estate bubble, I mean, that was the biggest warning sign out there when I saw what he did to the internet boom. And so we stopped buying. And at that point in time, we had only had two properties that we were sitting on. So, you know, we began effectively transitioning before it. And a lot of people were calling us crazy or, you know, undercutting the market, those sorts of things. But it allowed us to have a great amount of flexibility that we could change our product and still be, you know, to keep our doors open and our lights on versus a lot of people that just lost everything during that time.
Mm. You mentioned also in your bio that I read talks about that a lot of these self-storage facilities are managed by the top three operators. What do you mean by that?
Well, they're known as the REITs. So those would be like the Extra Space, the CubeSmarts, the Life Storage. Those are the major players in the arena. And so most of those companies all have what they call third-party management, where we can hire them to run our facility. So it's no different than when you walk into a Holiday Inn, you don't really know who owns that Holiday Inn or that Hyatt, but you see the branding on the outside or even a McDonald's. You don't know who actually owns that location, but you know that there's a brand out there. And so we do the same thing, is that instead of like a joint venture or a lease, we're actually hiring these companies to run our facility. And that way we get their national branding, we get their national systems. So we do what we do well, which is real estate development. And we let them do what they do well, which is self-storage.
Interesting. It seems like they would want to hire you instead of the other way around, you know, to go out and find, you know, new facilities for them, you would think.
In essence, they do, because they become the buyers.
Mm, okay. So do they ever say, hey, you know, we're looking for new properties in this area. You guys go after it and turn your market research on and so forth to find those properties for them?
They're not that overt, but we do have that conversation with the feasibility consultants. And so we will have that conversation being like, where do you see an underserved area? Where are you seeing, you know, great rental rates that doesn't have the supply? And so we have altered our search criteria based upon that, knowing that there's hidden areas that where we can go in and fill the demand side.
Gotcha. Well, we have, as you know, an audience of what we call 50 plusers, those that are 50 years of age and older. They're either approaching retirement or they're already in retirement. And these folks are looking at real estate as a means to either supplement their retirement or be able to provide opportunities so that they can have the kind of retirement that they want. And from your experience, what would you say for our audience would be a good way for them to actually, you know, get in there and sort of benefit from some of the great things going on in the real estate area?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to recognize that you have to be able to assess the level of risk in any investment opportunity, whether that be, you know, a single family all the way up to a REIT. You know, there's an inherent amount of risk that's going to be associated with each of these. So how do you monetize that? How do you assess it? And I think that, you know, obviously cap rate is one way to do that, which is hard to span it across all the different asset classes. But I think that, you know, you have to really look at, you know, what is the underlying concepts? What are the underlying economics of it? And what is the market? So part of that is if someone who's, you know, let's just say in the second half of their career and they're looking to get involved with it, rather than starting from scratch, I would say look to partner up with someone who is doing it. And then that way you can utilize their strengths to, you know, enhance their investment. You know, a lot of our investors are approaching that point in their life stage or their cycle. I mean, they're, you know, maybe on plus or minus 5-10 years on either side. And so they're seeing like, okay, I don't have the effort or the bandwidth to take on a whole new development or try to get into this from scratch, but how can I partner up with a lot of other people in order to make sure that my investment is safe and it will grow appropriately? And they're willing to take a little bit more risk. I mean, you know, speculative development is more risky than if you're just buying an existing apartment building. But with that comes that level of risk, then, you know, the reward is obviously there as well. So if you're looking for, let's just take self-storage. If you're looking for just an annuity or a bond, then you could certainly buy an existing facility and clip that ticket, if you will. You know, if you want to expand it a little bit, then that would be on the development side. So even within that arena of self-storage, there's different levels of risk and obviously compensated on the backside as well.
And I know this is not easy to answer, but you know, roughly what kind of returns are people getting that are investing in self-storage right now?
If they're buying an existing facility and they're looking to improve it, they might buy it at a 9 cap and maybe move it to an 8 or, you know, 7.5 cap. And so those are the smaller, what we call, you know, original class of self-storage, which is, you know, more rural, the classic drive up garage door, you know, the grounds may or may not be paved. They might be gravel, but there's no climate control. You know, what we're doing is now considered Class A, which is fully climate controlled facilities where you drive into them and they're, you know, you're never outside. You can literally unload your car or your truck inside the building. So, and those, you know, you might see, you know, anywhere from a 9 to top of 15% rate of return. We were just at an event where we were with, you know, about 70 different self-storage operators, and we were all just talking about the marketplaces and what things we've been seeing in the marketplaces and how to improve upon things. And one guy, you know, he for the first 4 years didn't really have any positive cash flow because he had to reinvest in it. In year 5, he sold it and, you know, he took a $1 million facility and turned it into a $1.7 million facility. So, I mean, he did very well, but he had to be very patient and he got the reward on year 5. You know, that sort of type investment is good for, you know, a single investor type entity, but we obviously couldn't make that work in terms of what we're trying to do. You know, when we're doing speculative development, we recognize that we got to be 20% or greater in order just to attract the marketplace to get that rate of return. And so, you know, we won't model anything less than 20%. And if the rate of returns are coming in under 20%, we won't even do it.
Wow, that's great. That's actually pretty strong. Well, your company, it seems like you have a great niche. I mean, all I keep hearing is, you know, how great things are happening in the self-storage arena. What are your plans for the, you know, sort of the short and long term for your company? What's the vision that you have that really excites you about the future?
Well, our goal when we really began, we tested the model for a few years with it, and then we decided, hey, we're going to try to get 10 of these facilities within 5 years. And we felt that if we had 10 facilities that we could bunch together, we could get greater cap compression in the marketplace and unload it to the REITs. And so, you know, our philosophy is the best time to sell real estate is when you don't need to, because people are willing to pay you the most for it at that point in time. And so if we can have cash flowing facilities that are generating a good rate of return in our cost basis because of the fact that we're buying these existing facilities, you know, well below replacement costs, our goal is to, you know, have a cost basis of 65 to 70% of value. So that way we can refinance out our investors' equity and still cash flow them and our investors stay in the deal. And so if we can be cash flowing with having no equity in the deal, and then decide when we need to the best to sell them, that is our ultimate goal. And so we're in halfway through our 5-year plan, and we're now working on our 6th facility that will be in that portfolio.
That's exciting. That's great. Well, we're I probably have asked way too many questions here, but I want to learn and understand, you know, what exactly is happening in that space and what opportunities there are, for sure. We're kind of running the clock here, and we've come up to what we call our wrap it up session, where I ask you a series of quick questions just to get ideas on resources that you found valuable so we can share that with our listeners. So if you are ready, we can go ahead and do our wrap it up.
Okay, very good.
All right. Favorite real estate book?
Well, I classify real estate and books together because of the fact that I take a lot of the concepts that are not in real estate and apply them. I take business books in general and apply them to our real estate because I see real estate as just the vehicle by which we conduct our business. So right now, my favorite book is The Road Back to You by Ian Morgan Crone. No relationship to me, so I'm not getting any residuals off of it. but it's a different spelling. It's a book about personalities and how to assess your own personality and then how you can see those personality traits in other people and then better relate to those people. And so that's something that we have done throughout our company. And so that I can better interact with the people that I work with, as well as our customers, and understand their perspective of what they're bringing to the table. And then I can change my form of communication to best relate to them. And so I found that book to be incredibly beneficial, not just in my own personal life, but in my family life, as well as in my business life.
Oh, that's great. And this one you may have already answered, but I'll ask it here. What about a more general business book that might be a favorite or a classic to you?
Well, my mentor has written a lot of great books. His name is Dr. Nito Cobain. And I get a tremendous amount out of him in terms of all the, I mean, he's in the Speaker Hall of Fame, and he's a Horatio Alger Award winner for Distinguished Americans. And so he's been very kind to me and giving me a lot of his resources, not just his books, but, you know, the time that we were mentoring together. And I find everything that he does to be incredibly beneficial for me.
Is there one particular book that stands out that he has?
There's a good one called The Stairway to Success. And, you know, but he also has books on leadership. He's the president of High Point University and he also owns Great Harvest Bread and Lazy Boy. And he's on the board of BB&T Bank. And so, you know, he came from Lebanon when he was 16 with like minimal amount of money in his pocket. And he's just, you know, developed and grown his life to a level of success. And so, you know, that is one of the big lessons that I always take away from is, you know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon.
Got it. What would you say is your most valuable website for success, one that you use on a pretty regular basis?
Well, right now, the current site that I'm utilizing is it's an opportunity zone map. And so what we are doing is one of the things that we're looking for is it's not the main criteria that we're using. But it is a factor in terms of our site assessment. And so, you know, we're going there pretty regularly to determine whether or not a property is in an opportunity zone in terms of how we can utilize that within our business strategy.
Yeah, that's an area that's really exploded just recently. That's great. That's great. How about favorite app?
The favorite app, I mean, I would say is our is our contact management. So that would be HubSpot. And so it's very helpful in terms of us making sure that we have reminders and follow-ups and being able to distribute things to our investors and things along those lines.
Got it. How about favorite quote?
That would go back to Dr. Cobain. You know, he was saying that you divide your life into thirds. So you have one third of learning, one third of success, and then another third of giving. And so, you know, if you look at each part of your life and you divide it into thirds, and if you really focus on those three different things, then that will set you up for that stairway that he was describing in his book, The Stairways to Success.
And this is our sort of our big question here. If, let's say, you lost everything you had, okay, and you absolutely had nothing left, all you had was $1,000 in cash. What would you do with that $1,000 to rebuild your company?
Well, I would invest in education to determine, how I could do things better, you know. And, you know, when I was saying that, you know, the greatest failure, I mean, I did do that. I did invest a significant amount of money in terms of like how to improve the way in which we were doing business. So, you know, was it down to my last $1,000? No, but, you know, did I have to start over again? I felt like it because of the fact that, you know, we really had to analyze everything that we were doing in the company. And so that's what I've always done. Whenever there was a challenge, like in the recession or that period of time, I've always doubled down in terms of my education to make sure that I was like, how to do things better. And I think it's, you know, it'd be ignorant on my part to think, well, I've done it for 20 years, so therefore I know how to do it. But if I'm not doing it well, then how can I take that, you know, that prideful approach to it? So we're always looking for ways in which to improve. You know, one of the things that Dr. Cobain says is, you know, you're not expected to be perfect. You're expected to be better. So every day, can you be better as opposed to being perfect?
I like that. That's great. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of folks that are listening that want to find out more about you, about your company. What's the best way for folks to find those things out or to reach you?
The best website would be www.codamg.com. So that's CODA, M as in management, G as in group.com. And we have, contact information on there. Plus we have blogs and other resources that people can see of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And so that's one of the best ways to get hold of us.
That's great. That's great. Well, we'll also have a link to that in our show notes as well. Wow. Well, this has been really fascinating for me, Scott. Some great information there. I mean, I just your story is amazing. I was thinking too, and you had this fourth generation business, and did as a kid, did you ever like work in the in the factories, with the tool and die area as a kid, or is that something you didn't really interface that much with?
I did work at the company for couple months, but it was not in the factory. I was working in the office, and my primary task was trying to clean up the sales and contact list. And keep in mind, this is when, a computer filled an entire 10 by 20 room, and I had to go through sheets of dot matrix, printouts to determine, which companies were still in existence and who the right contact was. And so I spent a lot of time just trying to update that information and such. So it was
more on the admin side, right?
Totally on the admin side, right?
Weren't there pouring into the molds or any of that stuff now? That's great. That's great. Well, thanks so much for being on, Scott. You have a great story to tell. Sounds like a fantastic business. You found an excellent niche, and definitely want to hear more about how things move forward with you and your company. So we want to thank you for that. But before you go, we're not done yet. We have one tradition here on this show that our guests just love, and that is our closing howl. So I know, you've been probably practicing a little bit here on this one. And so we're just going to let you close us out with your best old hound dog howl. So go for it, Scott.
Ow!
That was good. That was good.
I did have a beagle growing up.
I love it. Well, thanks again, Scott, for joining us. I really appreciate you giving us your time today.
Thank you very much for having us. It was a pleasure.
Oh, and I also want to just thank all our old dog listeners out there for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we greatly appreciate it. And please note everything presented here today, including some of these links and references that Scott made, they can all be accessed in our detailed show notes on the Old Dogs website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog. And just look for the episode with Scott Krohn. So that's the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward. and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.